From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a period when the press was partisan, mudslinging, vile, and unjust. That period is the time just before and after the Revolutionary War. We'll talk with Eric Burns about his new book, Infamous Scribblers, The Founding Fathers and the Rowdy Beginnings of American Journalism. He says the golden age of America's founding was also the gutter age of American reporting. Also, two of the people behind the great gospel recording that Kanye West sampled in his hit Jesus Walks. We'll hear from James Allen, the founder of the Addicts Rehabilitation Center Choir in Harlem, and Curtis Lundy, the choir leader. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new book describes a period when the press was partisan and at times vile, crude, unjust, and more likely to incite than inform. The period being described here? Colonial America. My guest, Eric Burns, is the author of the new book, Infamous Scribblers, The Founding Fathers and the Rowdy Beginnings of American Journalism. It covers the period just before and after the Revolutionary War. Among the people Burns writes about are Founding Fathers Ben Franklin and Sam Adams, who are also publishers. Burns is the host of Fox News Watch, the Fox News Channel's weekly roundtable of media criticism featuring a panel of liberals and conservatives. Burns is also a former NBC News correspondent. He won an Emmy Award for media criticism. In his book, Infamous Scribblers, Burns writes that the golden age of America's founding was also the gutter age of American journalism. Here's an example.
Samuel Adams, who makes a much better brand of beer than he did a brand of journalism, Samuel Adams so wanted to incite his fellow Bostonians and countrymen to revolution, to independence, that he wrote, Terry, fiction. He would write articles about soldiers who were on patrol in Boston, for instance, assaulting women on the streets. Incidents that never happened. He encouraged, once the Stamp Act was passed, encouraged in an article violence against a man named Andrew Oliver, whose charge it was to collect the Stamp Act taxes. Not only that, but after he wrote the article, and I'm not sure exactly what the article said, but I know one of the things he suggested was that Oliver be hanged in effigy. That night, he gathered some of his friends, who were known to fellow patriots as the Sons of Liberty and known to the British by far more derogatory terms. He gathered them together, and he told them how to take matters into their own hands. His article, in other words, wasn't enough in terms of being incendiary. He said, listen, fellas, go to Oliver's house, throw bricks and stones and rocks through the windows, trash the guy's house. And when you see him, tell him there will be a lot more in store for him if he doesn't resign his position. This was done. Oliver resigned his position.
Did this change your impression of Samuel Adams?
Tremendously. I read several biographies of Sam Adams, and he was a journalist longer than he was anything else. I mean, he was also the governor of Massachusetts for a while, and he did a lot of really admirable things. But the people who write the overarching biographies, as opposed to what I did, which is to say look at Adams simply through the prism of his journalistic practices, tend to dismiss his journalism in just a few phrases by saying that he was rebellious. He tried to stir the colonists to independence. He might not have been the most factual fellow, but his heart was in the right place. That kind of thing, and that is in fact the reason that he has been not just forgiven but exalted by history. He was thoroughly disreputable as a journalist in the most noble of causes. And so when we look at the whole man, as most biographers of Adams do, we conclude that he did the right thing. It's a question of means and ends, and this is a case of the ends justifying the means in the case of most historians and biographers.
I think we'd like to think that journalistic ethics does not forgive making up lies for a just cause.
Well, journalistic ethics don't. But when you write a biography of someone like Sam Adams, you make journalistic ethics simply one category. And, you know, to me, Terry, that was the really interesting thing about writing this book. If you write, let's say, a biography of Thomas Jefferson, it's like standing in front of Jefferson and seeing him from head to toe. It's a look at the whole man. But when you do what I did, which is examine Jefferson and various other founders just in terms of how they reacted to and how they were part of the world of journalism, it's like bringing him very close to you and then putting a magnifying glass under a small part of him. It's not an accurate total picture of the person, but it's a fascinating view of one part of that person.
Okay, you mentioned Jefferson. What's his connection to the press?
When Jefferson served in the Washington administration, he was the Secretary of State. He would take State Department money and use it to fund a newspaper called the National Gazette, which trashed the policies of the administration, the Washington administration, in which he served. Government money going against government policy. And not only that, Terry, what he would do is occasionally he would leave his office door, the door to the State Department, unlocked at night. He would leave papers on his desk, which either in and of themselves or quoted out of context would make the Washington administration look bad. And the editor of the National Gazette, the most famous poet of the time, Philip Freneau, would come in at night, sneak these papers out, put them in the National Gazette. And when Washington at some point later on wondered about this and said to Jefferson, "Is there anything we can do to get the National Gazette to tone it down?" Jefferson said, "Well, I'll try, but I don't really know Freneau that well, and I don't really have much of a connection with the paper." He was telling a lie, and he was being, in his own way, as unethical as Sam Adams had been for his cause.
So Jefferson was not only a founding father, he was a founding leaker, one of the first leakers in America.
Actually, you know, historians say that the leak was invented by George Washington and that it was done with all the sophistication of a modern president leaking. Washington, I think, Terry, was the greatest victim of the American press ever to sit in the White House. He did not, of course, sit in the White House. We didn't have a White House then. But to try to control, damage control is the phrase we would use today, it was Washington who first came up with the idea of the journalistic leak and had his cabinet officers take people out, buy him a beer or two, and say, "Listen, here's some information just for you."
You brought up Washington, and how he was handled in the press is a good example of how partisan the press was back in early American history. There was a campaign in a paper called The Aurora, which was published by Ben Franklin's grandson,
right,
to force Washington out of office. To retire immediately.
Yeah, I don't know that it was necessarily a campaign. It might, Terry, have been the whole reason that the paper existed. But one of the articles that wanted Washington out of the office, in fact, began with the phrase you just mentioned, "retire immediately." And then it went on as follows. "Let no flatterer persuade you to rest 1 hour longer at the helm of state. You are utterly incapable to steer the political ship into the harbor of safety. If you have any love for your country, leave its affairs to the wisdom of your fellow citizens. Do not flatter yourself with the idea that you know their interests better than other men. There are thousands amongst them who equal you in capacity and who excel you in knowledge." Terry, this was not an editorial. There were no editorials at the time. This was simply an article in an American newspaper of the colonial period.
We said it was, in a way, the function of that paper, The Aurora, to get Washington out of office. How was the paper founded by Ben Franklin's grandson?
How was it founded?
Yeah, I mean, did he actually create it with the purpose of getting Washington out of office?
He created it with the purpose of getting federalism to be discredited, because once Washington was out of office, the paper continued to exist for a while, although Benjamin Franklin Bache died at the age of 29, so it didn't last terribly long. But he was just as vicious with Adams, who was also a federalist.
We're talking about how partisan the press was in colonial times and in the early United States, and how some things were just made up. There's a paper called The Wasp. This was a small paper in Hudson, New York. And on the masthead, where the New York Times, for instance, has all the news that's fit to print, the Wasp had, "To lash the rascals naked through the word." I was like, what a motto. What was that paper like?
That paper was like the motto would suggest. To me, the really salient point here is why were papers like this at a time when such intellectual giants strode the earth? The two problems with the press then, and why I think they existed: unfairness and viciousness. Papers were unfair at the time, most simply put, Terry, because there was no tradition of fairness. If you owned a press, you were a businessman, and for someone to ask you to be fair would be to ask you to include points of view other than your own, which would be to ask you, in effect, to advertise your competitors. That's how people looked at it back then. And with no tradition of fairness to call on, the printer of a paper would say, why should I? And, I mean, it would be like a blacksmith saying, well, sure, I can shoe your horse, but if you take it down the street, the guy will do it more quickly and more cheaply. It wasn't going to happen. Why was it so vicious? I believe that the two most important events in American history, and I would rank the Civil War third, happened during this era. First, of course, was the Revolutionary War, and second was the battle to interpret the Constitution, which is to say to decide what kind of country the Revolutionary War was going to produce. With events of this magnitude following one upon the other, I think that even the noblest of people felt this. There is simply too much at stake these days for civility. And I think these are the reasons that the press at this time was what it was like.
And you're making it sound like publishers saw their papers as just mouthpieces and megaphones for their views.
They did. They did. Fairness didn't really come into the press, and I don't even get into this in the book because I'm talking about colonial times. But the single most important event in making the press fair, Terry, didn't happen until after the Civil War, when wire services started. The Telegraph allowed the Associated Press to come into existence, and the Associated Press simply didn't have time to come up with several different versions of one story. You know, the right-wing version, the left-wing version, the sensational version, the restrained version. Fairness came about because the Associated Press really had time in conveying all the news to all its subscriber papers just to write one version. So they tried to be as middle of the road as they could. But before that, few people saw the reason for a newspaper to be fair because the guy who owned it would have been working against his own ideological interests if he were fair.
Was there anything that could be called independent journalism back in the early period of American history? You know, you've got publishers, but you got publishers using newspapers as a mouthpiece. Are there reporters? Are there reporters who have, you know, who actually go out and just report accurately on what they're seeing?
Actually, Terry, there weren't even reporters until probably, certainly not in any great numbers, until after the war. The way the Revolutionary War was covered, for instance, is quite instructive. I know of one man, the publisher of the Massachusetts Spy, who went out and covered a couple of stories himself. But by and large, the Revolutionary War was covered through the mail. That is to say, soldiers would send letters back home to loved ones, and those would be given to newspapers. Sometimes letters would be written specifically to newspapers. But there were no such things as reporting staffs. By and large, the printer stayed in his shop and hoped that someone would come in with some information. In terms of independent journalism, if by that you mean journalism that was unbiased, no, I encountered none of it. Now, I did encounter some professions of it, which is to say there were a few papers at the time which claimed that they were beholden to no one, that they would print the truth as they saw it, but they almost always saw it through one particular set of lenses.
My guest is Eric Burns. His new book is called Infamous Scribblers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Burns. His new book is called Infamous Scribblers, The Founding Fathers and the Rowdy Beginnings of American Journalism. He's a former NBC News correspondent and now hosts Fox News Watch, the Fox News Channel's weekly roundtable of media criticism. Now, one of the things I find interesting about your show is that the two liberals and the two conservatives with you as moderator usually have a pretty civil conversation with each other and even laugh at each other's jokes, assuming there's any wit behind the jokes.
Wait a minute. And, are you criticizing the jokes that we write and saying that they don't work?
That was the main point of the question. No, but I mean it's and sometimes people surprise you, and you know, a liberal and a conservative on the show will agree with each other instead of arguing with each other. Do you feel like on a lot of shows that liberals and conservatives are almost playing a part in a play that's already been written, and that it's their job to represent the official conservative or the official liberal point of view, and to never waver from what that official position is to be, and to never think that an issue is ambiguous.
Without question, they're on most shows, they're like a repertory company. They know their roles. The dialogue changes because the issues change, but they know who they're supposed to be. I, as far as I'm concerned, and you may either back me up, criticize me, or move on to another topic, but I don't think that happens on Fox News Watch. Every possible pairing you could imagine has taken place at some point on that show. Gabler, the self-described progressive, agreeing with Thomas, the family values conservative. I mean, there are some issues that bring everybody together, it seems to me, because it's not just a matter of addressing political bias on the show, which frankly I find a little tedious and predictable occasionally. There are far bigger problems with the media today than political bias, because political bias, it seems to me, Terry, is a pretty easy thing to identify. But sensationalism, misplaced priorities, laziness, stories that should be covered and that are not covered, just plain accuracy, these to me are much more important issues than, you know, whether President Bush was traduced by this paper, or whether John Kerry during the election got an unfair shake from this paper.
Now, do you identify yourself publicly as liberal or conservative?
No, and I take a great deal of pride in getting emails that I get with some frequency from people who say, "I've been watching your show for years and I have no idea what you are." I have not been hired by Fox to express political views. My own personal feeling is that my political views are A, my own business, and B, not a part of Fox News Watch. There are four people on that show who have been chosen because not just of journalistic expertise, but because they have certain political starting points from which they approach issues. A half-hour program doesn't need a fifth person like that, and I have made it a point, and in fact, I hope I'm not overstating the case, a badge of honor to be unidentified politically. And I hope you don't know what I am, do you? You watch the show.
Well, I don't, but you know, I assume a lot of people say to you, "Oh, sure, you don't identify publicly as liberal or conservative, but if Fox hired you, you must be conservative."
Well, there's nothing I can do about that. Neil Gabler is rabidly not conservative. Alan Colmes is. As a matter of fact, I saw an article some time ago about, you know, Fox, I think, has more opinion givers than any other network, and therefore you can put what I'm going to say right now into that context. But Fox has, according to some article I read in one of the broadcast publications, more openly avowed liberals on its payroll as contributors, which is to say, you know, people who are called on from time to time to offer opinions, than any other network.
Do you watch the Daily Show and the Colbert Report? And I wonder how you think they're affecting the news and how people see the news.
Well, actually, I'm going to be on The Daily Show pretty soon, so I have been studying it more than ever. It's an intriguing show, isn't it? Because the interviews are very often with serious people. I'd like to consider myself one, and the rest of the show isn't serious. I will quote from one of my panelists, Neil Gabler, about The Daily Show, and I think he makes a very perceptive point. It's frightening to think that there might be people who depend on The Daily Show as their sole source of news. That charge is leveled against young people. I don't know how accurate it is. But the point Gabler makes is that what he thinks is so valuable about The Daily Show, and I agree, is, and this is his phrase, The Daily Show gets it. A conventional newscast is supposed to be objective. I'm looking for a phrase other than cut through the BS, because I would like to say something a little more eloquent than that, but nothing comes to mind. That's what that show does. That show, it seems to me, tells you the truth in a manner not only humorous, but if you analyze it, pretty hard-hitting. It points out the fakery, for instance, of the political statement, the speciousness of certain things that on a regular newscast would be presented without comment, because that's what journalists are supposed to do. So apart from the humor, the service that it performs, I think, is to it just presents truth very often at a deeper level. It doesn't buy the pretense of a lot of, in particular, politicians' statements.
Eric Burns, thank you so much for talking with us.
The pleasure was mine, Terry. Thank you for the invitation.
Eric Burns is the author of Infamous Scribblers, The Founding Fathers and the Rowdy Beginnings of American Journalism. He hosts the media show Fox News Watch on the Fox News Channel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luke Sant, available in stores and online. And from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I just want to thank you, Lord. I just want to thank you.
We're listening to the Addicts Rehabilitation Center Choir of Harlem. One of their gospel tracks was sampled in Kanye West's hit Jesus Walks. Coming up, we'll talk with choir founder James Allen, who kicked his own habit in 1957, and bassist and choir leader Curtis Lundy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the great things about Kanye West's hit Jesus Walks is the gospel record it samples with that great vocal bass line. I wanted to find out more about that group, so my guests are the two leaders of the ARC Choir, the Addicts Rehabilitation Center Choir. James Allen founded the choir in 1970 to help support the Addicts Rehabilitation Center, which he had worked with since giving up alcohol in 1957. Curtis Lundy is a jazz bass player who is the choir director. When he first came to the choir in 1992, he was addicted to cocaine. All the singers in the choir are former addicts. Before we meet Allen and Lundy, let's hear Kanye West's Jesus Walks, which samples the ARC Choir's 1996 recording, Walk With Me.
Yeah. We at war. We at war with terrorism, racism, but most of all, we at war with ourselves. God, show me the way because the devil's trying to break me down. Know what the Midwest is, young and restless, but restless might snatch your necklace, and next these might jack your Lexus. Somebody tell these who Kanye West is. I walk through the valley of the shadow where death is. Top floor, if you alone, I leave you breathless. Try to catch it, it's kinda hard getting choked by the Texas. Yeah, yeah, and I check the method. They be asking us questions, harassing, arresting, saying we eat pieces of like you for breakfast, huh? Y'all eat pieces of what's the basis? We ain't going nowhere but got suits and cases. A trunk full of rental car from Avis. My mama used to say only Jesus could save us. Well, mama, I know I act a fool, but I'll be gone till November. I got packs to move. I hope
Jesus,
God, show me the way because the devil's trying to break me down. The only thing that I pray is that my feet don't fail me now. Nothing I could do now to right my wrongs. I wanna talk to God, but I'm afraid cause we ain't spoken so long.
James Allen, Curtis Lundy, I want to welcome you both to Fresh Air. What can you tell us? What do you know about how Kanye West decided to use your choir's record and his track, Jesus Walks?
Well, in my conversation with Kanye, Kanye heard it and he liked it, and he said that you know, it just gave him a different kind of energy that he felt he could work with. And from that, I think he started working on the actual lyrics for the rap, and it all came together.
James Allen, how do you like it musically?
I like it better when we do it, but
I know you're not part of the hip-hop generation or generations.
True. But actually, I had been trying to arrange that song for a couple of years, and then I turned it over to Curtis, and he has a unique background rhythm to it that really moves people.
Yeah, well, Curtis Lundy, I love what you've done with this song. And first of all, what made you think of doing it as a march? I mean, Kanye West really makes it into a march. He adds snare drums. But right. It's a march just with the choir. What made you hear it that way?
Well, the word walk.
Mm-hmm.
And wanting Jesus to walk with me. It just, you know, as a musician, imagination is a big part of music. And if you don't use your imagination, then, you know, you end up sounding like everybody else.
Why don't we hear the ARC Gospel Choir recording of Walk With Me? And this is the recording that Kanye West sampled in for his track. So here's how it sounds, just the ARC choir alone.
Jesus walk. Jesus walk. Jesus, walk with me.
I want Jesus.
That's the Addicts Rehabilitation Center Gospel Choir, and my guests are James Allen, the founder and executive director, and Curtis Lundy, the choir director. James Allen, you founded the Addicts Rehabilitation Center in 1957, and then founded the choir in 1970. Tell us the story of how the choir grew out of the rehab center.
In 1970, we were given a building as a donation for as a rehab residential drug-free treatment center. And it had a mortgage of $150,000. And we didn't realize that we had a low track record in raising money and that that mortgage was going to come due and we were going to lose the building. So somehow or another, when I was frustrated and wanted to quit, my wife said to me, "Why don't you pray about it?" Which I did. And the next day I went to work, and one of the guys that I was going to put out of the program because he was always running around singing, I got with him, and he suggested that we form a choir. And we did. And we started singing in local churches and telling them that we were going to lose our building. And they started contributing to us. And that's how the choir started. It started as a group that was going to raise money to pay off the mortgage. And we did. We paid off the mortgage. But then I realized that God had a deeper message than just paying off the mortgage. So we kept on singing.
What made you start to think that singing in the choir was actually helpful to addicts who are trying to stay straight?
They are the ones that convinced me of that. They kept saying that I'd never been in a program where people had the Spirit. And people are hungry, some people, for the Spirit of God to permeate their lives. And these people were the ones who got the message through my thick head. I'm a frustrated person who really had planned to play jazz music also on the guitar. And somehow or another, God has kept me so busy doing this stuff, I haven't had time to practice my chops.
Do you sing at all?
Well, yes.
You said that slightly hesitantly. Do you sing in the choir?
I do. There are some songs that I sing on.
Okay. So what are the ground rules for staying in the choir? I imagine part of the rules is that you have to stay straight.
Yes, you got to be straight and sober. And if you are in the program, many of the choir members are graduates of the program. There are some people who've been singing in it almost since its inception. And you have to remain sober. You have to have a behavioral pattern that's respected in the community because you're profiling yourself out there. And pretty much, you don't have to be the best singer in the world, because I have found that you can take bad voices, and if you can teach them how to breathe correctly, that it compensates for bad voices and they can learn how to carry the tune.
What are the auditions like?
Sometimes very, sometimes like Simon and American Idol.
He's right.
So, but if I could see if you're like Simon and American Idol, that you would not only be insulting their singing voices, but maybe challenging them about their ability to stay sober?
Well, actually, what happens is we don't come down heavy on people unless we're going to give them a shot afterward. We may say you sang terrible, but we'll let you stay and we'll teach you how to sing if you listen and pay attention. So that's the difference between us. If it's someone that really cannot sing at all, we sort of soften the blow. You know, if you part in company with someone, you should leave them with a good spirit. But you can come down on people if you plan to put pressure to them and teach them how to do something.
My guests are James Allen, founder of the ARC Choir, and Curtis Lundy, the choir director. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Boom, 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 boom. Boom, 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 boom.
We're talking about the ARC Choir, the Addicts Rehabilitation Center Choir of Harlem. The members are all former addicts. My guests are choir founder James Allen and choir director Curtis Lundy. Now, you both got to this point through being former addicts yourselves. So, James Allen, can you tell us your story? Like, what was your addiction, and how did you get over it?
Well, the first 7 years of my addiction was smoking marijuana, thinking it wouldn't lead on to something else. And then the next 10 years of my addiction, at least 7 of them, I slept in the streets of New York, literally, from basement to basement. And then somewhere in one of my cleanup periods, I met my wife, and we started staying together. She didn't know I was an addict, and when she found it out, she convinced, I say tricked me, into going to Lexington, Kentucky to kick my habit. And while I was at Lexington kicking my habit...
That's a prison, isn't it?
Yes. But back in the 50s, you could volunteer to go there for 6 weeks.
For rehab?
From all over the United States. Uh-huh. And you could withdraw, and you stay there for 6 weeks. I only stayed there for 30 days. While I was there, as soon as I sobered up, I realized two things. One was that I better go back to my wife, who was not my wife at the time, but I better go back to her. I hadn't planned on it when I left her, because she was the best woman I ever met in my life. The second thing was that I should try to embrace God, whom I had met with my grandparents down on a farm in Louisiana. So those two things worked for me. And how I got involved in drug rehab was, soon as I got back to New York, a week later, we went to a local church that I was planning on joining and eventually did join. And the minister was announcing that he was going to start working with addicts. So he wanted to have meetings, and anybody interested could come. So I became part of those meetings. And once that minister left the church, somehow or another, God put me in charge of the church's daycare program, which resulted in the establishment of the ARC residential program.
James Allen, you founded the Addicts Rehabilitation Center Choir in 1970, and Curtis Lundy, it was years after that. It was in 1992 that you came to the choir. You had become an addict yourself. What was your addiction?
Cocaine, and whatever way I could use it. Now, the only thing that might have saved me a little bit is I was terrified of needles. So, but that at the same time, that's one of the reasons why I started ingesting it by smoking it. And you know, of course, when you start to use drugs, nobody figures they're going to end up being an addict. And one day I was actually going out to COP to get some drugs, and I was walking one way on, 120th Street, I'll never forget that one, and I passed by this gentleman, and he passed by me, and then after about 10 paces, both of us stopped and turned around. It turns out the gentleman who turned around was someone who I had went to college with at the University of Miami. And he said, "I've been looking for you. I heard you were here." And later that day, he took me to ARC. And at that particular time, I didn't realize that it was going to be the beginning of my life, getting my life back.
Did he take you to hear it, or because he thought you should be part of it?
No, he took me to it because I looked like death walking, and he wanted me to get my life together. I didn't hear the choir until I was at ARC about 2 weeks, actually.
Oh, I see. So he took you to the rehab center, not to the choir.
Yeah, he took me directly to the rehab center.
Got it. And James Allen, when you realized that Curtis Lundy was a jazz musician, how long did it take you to find out about his background, to find out that he'd played with Betty Carter, for instance?
Well, he made sure that I knew all of that. And when he did, I made him promise me something. I made him put his bass down for how many months?
3 months.
I made him put his bass, promise to put his bass down for 3 months and not touch it. but to focus in on himself, because I recognized that he was using that as a badge of distinction and forgetting about the real Curtis behind that. So I made him zero in on himself, except for those times that I'm sure he cheated.
So you wanted him to find himself outside of the fact that he had stature in jazz, to just find his very
right.
essence beyond the success that he had achieved as a musician.
Yes.
Curtis Lundy, did that make sense to you?
At the time, no, but as I prayed on it and thought about it, yes, it did, because, you know, I feel like God had given me the talent and you know, my musical awareness, so if he wanted me to have it, he wouldn't take it away from me, you know. What was more important is that I realized that I needed to use it to help further what God's word is, which is to help each one, you know, be a better person. And, you know, if I got my life together, I knew my music would come back. So, you know, it's, you know, what came first, my life or my music? And my life came first.
James Allen, do you find you sometimes have to be very tough with some of the people in the choir to give them a sense of discipline and also just to keep them straight?
You asked him, but I can tell you, yes, he's a taskmaster. And
what does he do? People, what does he do?
Sometimes all he does is look at you, and that's enough. But he, you know, he can cut with the tongue a little bit. But you know what? He doesn't do it unless it's necessary, and I will give him that. Sometimes I you know, but one of Mr. Allen's, and this is something that I've learned from him. One of the things that I love about Mr. Allen, and I've seen him do it so many times, and he explained it to me, he has no problem tearing you down, but he will build you back up. He won't leave you broken and you know, just discouraged, and you know. But to get the message across, sometimes you got to cut a little deep, and he don't have a problem doing that.
Did somebody do that with you, James Allen? Did somebody play that role in your life?
My grandfather did. Understand, I'm 81 years old. I knew both my great-grandparents on both sides of the family. In fact, one of my great-grandmothers was a former slave. When the Civil War was over, she was 15. And I had all of these people on my back growing up.
So, but after you were addicted, was there somebody in your life who was really tough on you who helped you stay straight?
I didn't need that, only God.
My guests are James Allen, the founder of the ARC Choir, the Addicts Rehabilitation Center Choir, and Curtis Lundy, the choir director. Here's a track from the choir's 2004 album, Thank You, Lord, which is available in the States as an import. Lundy wrote the music and lyrics to this song, I Know a Man.
I know a man. Name is Jesus.
Only he can set you free.
When I was down, down,
place
my
feet on solid
Jehovah
ground. Jehovah Jireh
gave his life
a sacrifice for you and me.
That is why.
We'll talk more about the Addicts Rehabilitation Center Choir after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the ARC Choir, the Addicts Rehabilitation Center Choir, a gospel choir whose members are former addicts. My guests are choir founder James Allen and choir director Curtis Lundy. Was religion a part of your life before you got sober?
When I was a child, it was part of my life. But religion is not necessarily a part of my life now. Faith in God is a part of my life, but when it comes to religions, I respect them all, and I learn from all of them. But I don't subscribe to any particular one. Well, Protestant religions, any Protestant religions, that's what I'm a part of. It's inherent in me because it's part of my growing up. But I'm not a faithful participant in what you would call religion. In fact, I conduct a Bible fantasy where people can come and sit down and say what they believe, and nobody can't argue with them because we say we made it up in our mind. Nobody knows for sure, but if you like it, you can pick up pieces of it and add it to your life.
Curtis Lundy, was faith a part of your life before joining the Addicts Rehabilitation Center and the choir?
Yes, of course. To be honest with you, God bless her, my mother told me that I was not going to get my life together until I put God back in my life. And she was right. And, you know, I grew up in the church with my mother singing and my whole family. My grandfather built the church that I attended as a child. So to answer your question, yes.
Curtis Lundy, you've been the choir master of the Addicts Rehabilitation Center Gospel Choir for over a decade. So I'm wondering, do you still play in jazz bands? Do you still play bass in jazz bands? What's become of that part of your life?
Oh, it's still there. It never left. After I took my 3-month layoff, I picked my instrument back up. And as a matter of fact, Betty Carter called Mr. Allen one day and said, I need Curtis to take, you know, to do some gigs with me. And he graciously let me go. And Betty, at that particular time, was basically giving me an opportunity for other musicians to see that I was clean and sober and back on the scene.
Right.
So she helped me in that way, and I could never, never repay her. You know, I'm indebted to Betty all my life, actually. But that's, to answer your question, I'm back on the scene. I'm working, and I've been recording and doing my own CDs and things like that, and working with my sister a lot, and people like Bobby Watson and John Hicks. So I've been blessed to be accepted back to my position.
James Allen, you've been, you know, running an Addicts Rehabilitation Center since the late 1950s, and you've been running the choir since 1970. You were an addict before doing this work. That was a long time ago. That was in the 1950s. Do you feel, you're 81 now, do you still feel like it's hard work to keep sober, or is that like very much behind you?
All of that is behind me. I enjoy life. Somebody said to me once, if you do work that's gratifying, you'll never work again. So I don't look at this as being work.
Let me thank you both very much. James Allen is the director and the founder of the Addicts Rehabilitation Center Gospel Choir. Curtis Lundy is the choir director. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
We'll close with another track from the 1996 recording Walk With Me by the ARC Choir. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. We had help today from Sue Spolin. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, sit down, serve on.
Sit down,
serve on.
Sit down, serve on.
Sit down, serve on.
Bum 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 bum
Support for NPR comes from Warner Home Video with controversial classics, The Power of Media, DVDs of All the President's Men, Dog Day Afternoon, and Network, available now. From Diane Wolfe of New York and Washington, D.C., in great appreciation of NPR's mission to create a more informed public. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Borrowed Time, a novel of psychological suspense set in Britain by Robert Goddard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, living on the front lines of the abortion wars, we meet Eyal Press. His new memoir is about his father, an OBGYN who provides abortions as part of his practice in Buffalo. He was the target of protests and death threats. His associate, Dr. Barnett Slepian, was murdered by an anti-abortion extremist. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.